Hello and welcome to the Tortoise Shack. This morning I'm joined by Caroline West, who's filling in for Tony. Morning, Caroline. How are you?
Morning. I'm all good. Not here to talk about sex. It's unusual.
Now, let me get this out of the way. Tortoise Shack, we're putting out these pods, and I mean loads of pods. So please come on board and be a patron at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Now, let me just introduce Liam Carrick, director of ICCL. Liam, we're here today to discuss, firstly, we'll discuss the contact tracing app and the principles that you'd like to see followed. Will you tell us a bit more about the principles that you'd like to see followed?
Hi, Martin. So what we did this week is that ICCL, Digital Rights Ireland, and a wide range of some of the top technology and human rights experts in Ireland came together and issued 9 principles we believe that the government should take into account before it launches or tests a tracing app. Really, what we're talking about here are the essential legal requirements that the government should undertake if it wants to achieve public trust. And so, the first one is that any app must have a very narrow and specific function, must be for a very narrow function. And, you know, whereas we talk about a tracing app, there have been reports that the government is exploring something that will record symptoms as well. And we've seen in other countries even wider health data being collected. We want the government to show the effectiveness. And I think this is one of the key challenges here. There is deep that these type of apps actually work, that they serve any useful purpose. And if it doesn't work, well, then all of the other questions about proportionality really, you know, fall away. So it needs to show the effectiveness. It needs to show that this is proportionate and will achieve the end. And then transparency. You know, this is all about trust. At the end of the day, what we're seeing is that technology like this will only work if there's a high take-up. It's only a high take if the public trust it. So the government of things, their transparency, the key one is to show that it's conducted a data protection impact assessment and then share that. Share the source code, share the design specification and allow experts to interrogate it. And, you know, help. And I mean, there's a lot of expertise out there that wants to help with this. And we're producing these principles because we want to be helpful and constructive about something like this might work. In some respects, the government has shown a willingness to take into account these concerns, and it abandoned a centralized model where it would control the data and has gone, we understand, for a decentralized model. On the other hand, we hear this week that they're launching a test with members of An Garda Síochána before they've shared the data protection impact assessment, which I think is disappointing. What the oversight will be, we want to see what's the detail about deleting data. And if this is just for COVID, that it ends with COVID, that the whole system is removed afterwards. These are principles that are meant to be helpful, and we hope there'll be engagement. I think that the big real question with this technology is whether it works at all. And increasingly, there's skepticism about whether the Bluetooth technology is effective, whether it works at all times, in all places, with all models of phones. And there's also a question mark about what's the critical mass of people that you need to take part in this type of project to actually serve any function. And I think we really need the government to come out. What we're seeing now is that more countries seem walking away from this type of project because it's not really convincing that it's that useful, you know. And if the government believes that it is and it has evidence, you know, share it with us and let's have that discussion.
Do you think it's a time issue as well? Sorry, Martin. You know, like if this had been rolled out at the start of the pandemic, would there be more buy-in to it? Like at the moment, there's so much complacency around COVID, you know, if you go to a shop, there's hardly anyone wearing masks, social distancing is hit and miss. So do you think that level of complacency will impact that take up?
I mean, certainly there's question marks about, you know, how useful tracing, tracking people's movements and so on is at different stages. You know, maybe it might have been very useful at the very start. In a lockdown scenario, how useful is it at all? Does it become more or less useful as things open up? I think this is only one measure, and it's getting a lot of attention and focus, but is it a distraction, you know, from really what is the bread and butter here? You know, the bread and butter is, you know, testing and tracing and isolating people. And certainly in some countries like in Britain, there's been a lot of skepticism that all of the focus and the media coverage of the app is a welcome distraction about the failings that they've had in regard to testing and tracing, you know, human tracing. And I think that's something we really need to look at. You know, it's the old adage, for a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. There's tech companies that are developing this sort of stuff. They want to sell it. They're using COVID to normalize technology and surveillance. Not a tracing app. It's about use of drones. It's about use of thermometers. It's about databases. It's about a whole wide range of surveillance tools. And of course, from a technology perspective, you might always look for a technological solution. But it does seem, and we're all learning this, that the bread and butter here is having a good testing system and a good human tracing system that, you know, can track back through our contact center.
I believe the I believe the CMO has said that there is no substitute for shoe leather. And when we look at the UK today, the police in the UK have told the police not to use the app. And their app has gone from a contact tracing app to something completely different. Do we have a fear that that may happen here?
There's 2 points there, Martin. I mean, the first one is being no replacement for shoe leather. So let's look at what is and what isn't happening in Ireland at the moment. Okay. There's media reports this morning. We know that we've had a number of clusters in meatpacking factories. And there's reports in the papers this morning that a very significant proportion of the contacts of the positive results in meat factories haven't been followed up. You know that we need more resources to make our tracing here effective. And, you know, if we're not having that in place, what's the function of technology on top of it? You know, is it going to assist it or is it a substitute for it? The other question, I suppose, is about the classic kind of mission creep question about whether the app becomes something completely different. And we're certainly seeing that, you know, that it's connecting health data, personal data, that's much more widely used. So, you know, we're seeing in China, where apps are now, in some parts of the country, intended to be used on a permanent basis as health apps, you know. In the UK, there were proposals that the data that would be gathered by the app would be retained for 20 years. So way beyond what we expect will be the COVID period. And here, the HSE, which is not coming at this from the kind of surveillance perspective that we see in China or anything like that, but it was talking about an app that would record symptoms as well as do tracing. So then you're talking about a whole other set of questions and problems, you know. So I think all of these challenges are there. But, I mean, the starting point is, does this work? And then if it does work, you know, what are the dangers it presents? How much concerns and dangers?
You have, Liam, one of the points, the principles that you have is number 9, broaden the range of actors involved and foster engagement. Who are the actors that you're thinking of in that situation?
But primarily, I think we're thinking, Caroline, about, you know, technology and human rights and privacy experts. And, you know, what we're seeing is there's a huge generosity, I think, in the scientific community around COVID. There's a lot of people in different fields are sharing their expertise, making public. We're seeing experts in all of the Irish university and some of the large technology companies, you know, trying to solve problems here. And in many areas, that's been hugely positive about supply chain issues, about innovation for manufacturing devices, ventilators, and so on. You know, so this is all very, very, very healthy, and expertise is available here now. If there is a criticism of the Irish government's response to COVID, I think it is that it has been led by a fairly narrow level of expertise. You know, it's been epidemiology and public health. And I think that's a lot better than we see in countries like Britain, where it's not clear that the scientists are actually being listened to. But at the same time, it's a narrow range of everything from a risk perspective of minimizing spread of the disease, whereas there's other concerns too, you know. And I mean, one of the concerns we're seeing with our colleagues internationally is the concern of the short-term measure producing long-term problems. And especially this arises in relation to surveillance. It's not just about the tracing app. It's about all of the other surveillance technology as well. And there's a clear agenda for many people to normalize things like drones, for example. You know, I mean, not at all clear that drones help at all with the COVID response, but they're being equipped to police public areas, to have thermometers attached to them, to do crowd control. It's easy to make the case for extreme measures in a time of crisis. The problem is you end up with the extreme measure afterwards.
There's a question of proportionality. I think the question is proportionality. Firstly, does it do what it says on the tin? Will it be fit for purpose? Until you get past that, there is simply no point going any further than that. And there's echoes of the public services card here where we saw much mission creep. Do you think that failure on the public services card will affect public buy-in now? Do you think people are less trusting?
I think it's not just the public service card. I think the public does have a level of skepticism about the government's record in data protection and data management. And again, if we go back to the meatpacking, the meat plants issue, we had an incident where we know that personal data, and like highly sensitive personal data, people's medical test results were being shared with their employers. And it's very hard for the public to understand how something like that could happen or why something like that would happen, you know, even in an emergency situation. So I think debacles like that do undermine public confidence and public trust. What assists public confidence and public trust is transparency, you know, and we're trying to say, if you follow these steps, you're more likely to get cooperation. Like, we are skeptical, but we're open to evidence, you know, at all times. If they can show that this works, well, then we'll certainly be willing to engage with that. But at this stage, it's not convincing, you know.
And what happens is in the cases?
Sorry,
Miranda, I keep talking over you. In the cases of data breaches, like, is there a system already set up, or is it just a general report to GDPR agencies, or is there going to be a specific COVID data breach system that we're going to have? How's that going to work?
So that's a key question, and it's one of the principles we've outlined, is that, you know, what is the oversight? You know, what is the accountability mechanism here to see if things go wrong? And I mean, there is a role for the Data Protection Commissioner potentially here. It's been some confusing soundings, I think, from the HSE on this. They've talked about working with the Data Protection Commissioner, getting approval of the Data Protection Commissioner for it. Don't really a function for the Data Protection Commissioner in approving something like this, you know. But again, you know, until we see what their data protection impact assessment is, how they've teased out these questions themselves, then we won't really know. And I mean, I think this has been one of the big disappointments is the HSE said, yeah, we're going to do a data protection impact assessment and we'll share it at some point in the future around the time it gets launched. And that's not how this works.
That's not very reassuring at all.
It's not reassuring. I mean, we're not that sure that even the HSE itself is, you know, that this is coming from the HSE. You know, as Martin said, there have been voices from senior people within the medical side of things that there's skepticism about this too. You know, it is a shiny solution for a policymaker that this is a technological thing that solves all of these problems. I think that that's unlikely. I think that it is a combination of a lot of different things, and some of which are less sexy and are less shiny, and maybe are areas in which the government hasn't been doing as well as it might have done, you know? And of course, there is a danger this deflects accountability away from the hard yards that need to be carried out on this. And I suppose at the end of the day, as with everything to do with COVID, there's a whole lot of uncertainty at this point, and we're feeling a way through it. That's why you need to be careful about putting in place a mass surveillance tool in that kind of climate of uncertainty, and then having all these unintended and unforeseen problems down the line.
Do we know who is the data controller? Do we know for certain who the data controller is?
We haven't seen details on that, but certainly media reports have indicated that the HSE is the primary actor here, you know, that the HSE would be the primary agency involved. And in other areas, for example, with regard to passenger information forms at airports, it's been indicated that the HSE is the primary agency for controlling that information, although it can be shared with criminal justice agencies if there's a prosecution, you know. This is one of the dangers, you know, if you look internationally. In the US, we've heard reports this week that police services have been using data from the contact tracing apps for the purpose of monitoring and following up with protesters. Now, that's the kind of nightmare scenario you want to be avoiding, you know. But that's what's happening in some jurisdictions.
And that's very attractive to governments, even if the app at the end of the day is only used for a specific purpose. If there are add-ons or facilities for doing all of these other things, it's very difficult for any government to look at that and say, well, why don't we? It's there. And that is a real danger. That's exactly what happened with the public services card.
Yeah, if you create the capacity, that danger does arise. I mean, we know that we have legal protections in Ireland and in Europe, other parts of the world. But at the same time, that danger is there. I mean, some of the language and the discourse around this has been pointing to huge successes in other specific countries, like South Korea, for example. But I mean, I think when you actually look at what's going on in South Korea and you see that there's a database of everybody's public health records, that it's mixed with banking records, with CCTV tracking of individuals. This is a type of mass surveillance that, you know, is Orwellian, and it's a much abused term, but in the purest sense of the word is, and is something that could not be contemplated in a more democratic society like ours. So, you know, yes, this technology might have some functionality in that extreme surveillance context. Have the debate about all the other dimensions to that. Let's not talk about the tracing app in isolation. Let's look at everything else that's going on in that environment.
Liam, can I just since we're talking about mass surveillance, yesterday ICCL were tweeting about the Garda reaction to the protest, which was Black Lives Matter. Where does the ICCL stand on that? And I mean, in specifically a surveillance point of view.
Well, the question of surveillance and protests we've been working on for a number of years, and there's a number of issues that come up in recent years about police recording of protesters, mobile phone interception and protests, filming of protests and filming of police by protesters. All of these issues are very live. With regard to the Black Lives Matter issue, there's a very unusual and specific question at the moment that arises because the regulations create an offence of organising an event that violates public health. And I think we can all understand why that's necessary from a public health perspective now. The question is, I suppose, is should it be used against protesters? Now, there's a constitutional right to protest. It's a democratic freedom. In this instance, it seems that the protesters, the organisers, they did organise a public event, but they tried to abide by physical distancing as much as they could. They weren't as successful as they wanted to be because more people turned up. You know, the guards worked with them. What you're seeing there is the guards going to fairly extreme lengths to try to facilitate a protest, in fairness to them, and the protesters trying to comply with the law. But obviously a public health problem arose, you know. So I think it's a very specific instance. Our view is that it's not appropriate that these people should be prosecuted. You know, I don't think that's an appropriate function of the criminal justice system here. At the same time, if you're organising a protest at the moment, you should be responsible about public health advice. We've seen some of the groups have called off Black Lives Matter events this weekend. Those that are going ahead, we'd strongly encourage them to try to protect themselves and the people that they might meet by, you know, wearing masks and physically distancing and maybe trying to keep the protest within a reasonable size. But I mean, from a surveillance perspective, it's not clear that there was any violations of privacy. I mean, I think the guards were on bicycles and were trying to manage the situation fairly well. We've had seen other protests where maybe there's more deliberate and flagrant abuse of the law, but you know, I think everybody can do this in a responsible way.
Should the Garda power still be there at this present moment in time, Liam, or have we passed that line where we need extra Garda powers?
Well, our view is, and we said this yesterday, that this, I think, is the moment where we should lift the regulations, the actual legal powers of criminalisation, you know. And the government will be making a decision today on the 5th of June about that. The current regulations, this is the fourth version of regulations we've had since the start of April. They've all lasted for short periods of time between 4 days and 3 weeks. And the current regulations expire on Monday, on the 8th of June. So the government has to make a decision today about what it wants to do. And our view would be that this is the right moment to drop the regulations and go back to a public health approach. Which is what we had at the start. It's what we had between the 27th of March and the 7th of April. The guards were on the streets. They were advising people, giving people information, suggesting what they should do. And it seemed to work very, very well. You know, I think at this point now, the government hasn't come forward with any evidence to us, to the public, to say we still need police enforcement and criminalisation, that criminalisation is essential or more effective than just advice. We haven't seen that evidence. If that evidence isn't there, if they're not making that case, well, they should go back to the least invasive approach, which is just trust and confidence and consent. And there's an added practical point as well here, which is that we expect today that they'll be loosening up the advice about restrictions, and senior guards have expressed the view that it's just impractical. You can't actually have powers of arrest and enforcement when the law is so vague and unclear, you know, that like there's so many reasons now for a person to be out and about in either work or shopping or movement or family or exercise, that it puts the guards in an invidious position of trying to enforce that law, and actually can undermine the rule of law because it's too uncertain, you know. And I think this is a good moment to do that. And I think it would be a huge achievement for Irish society that we introduced extreme powers, we had a high level of compliance and cooperation, and then we were able to drop them and return to normal. I mean, that'd be a huge achievement. It may be necessary to retain some rules about people who organise mass events or, you know, public order violations, large meetings that are a big danger. But individual action at this stage, we don't feel should be criminalised.
I've just got a breaking news notification on my phone there to say that the government is considering free travel anywhere inside your own county. So they seem to have jumped from 5K, skipped the 20K and allowed for your own county. Obviously, some counties are bigger than the others, so that's going to be different. So does that news impact your feeling then about the protests as well, if we're allowed to travel, you know, potentially hundreds of kilometres now?
I suppose one of the questions about this type of approach is, you know, is this just a vice or is this going to be policed? You know, we don't have any legal distinction between one county and another, you know. We don't have borders of counties. And also what's critical here as well from a legal point of view is that whereas the law allows the minister to designate some parts of the countries as affected areas and others not, they've never done that. So the whole country, from a public health point of view, has been treated as one unit, you know. So I don't know how you'd enforce county boundaries. If advice, it might be sensible and practical advice. That's a fair point. But, of course, it is different. I mean, I live in Dublin. There's a million people living in the same county as me within 50 kilometres of where I live. I have family members who are in Donegal, you know, who might be 100,000 people within 100 kilometres of where they live. It's a different ballpark. And as you say, some counties are bigger than others. In terms of the protest, in fairness, I think the issue with the protest is actually about some public health risks that arise in a protest context. You know, congregation of large numbers of people in a small place. If people are shouting slogans, that presents a particular threat in terms of communicating the virus through somebody's mouth, you know. Those kind of issues, particularly in a built-up area like the Black Lives Matter protest last week, they do present challenges for the protesters themselves, for the police, and for the people living in the community. It's a different thing if you're in the Phoenix Park. We've seen from colleagues internationally, for example, in Israel, where the law specifically protected the right to protest. So it was a reasonable excuse for movement. But then there were rules, and people would mark out an area for a protest with 2 meter separate boxes, and then the protesters would wear masks, you know. We've seen violent protests. So, you know, I think we have to be practical and realistic about this too and recognise risks. In fairness to the people involved last weekend, they were trying to do their best with it, you know. And I don't think that they should be criminalised. I don't think anybody should be prosecuted when they're trying to, exercise their democratic rights and trying to comply with the law. Like, they contacted the guards in advance and gave them information about their plans and intent. At the same time, if you are organising a protest this weekend, we would strongly encourage people to make sure that you're safe and that, you know, everybody else is safe as well. And I think there's things you can do to make that happen.
Liam, thank you very much for your time this morning. And we'll include a link for ICCL. ICCL could always do with a few bob, people. Always do with a few bob. So we'll stick a link there for you, Liam. And just want to say again, thank you for getting the sunset clause put into the special powers, and hopefully we won't have them for that long. Hopefully they're gone before then. Thanks for your time, Caroline. Thank you for your time this morning.
No, thanks, Martin. Thanks, Liam.